Professor Lawrence Krauss, our guest. We're going to take your phone calls. I've got a few more Star Trek questions, and then we'll get right into it on Coast to Coast AM. Professor, before we take the calls, let's get back into Star Trek for just a moment. They used to have this deflector shield that they'd be able to raise and, you know, lower whenever they wanted to stop incoming. What about the possibilities of that in defense?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think it's precisely that kind of science fiction. In Star Trek, in almost every science fiction show, they've had deflector shields or impenetrable shields. And I frankly think that was one of the reasons that Ronald Reagan first got excited with the idea of a Star Wars shield. And unfortunately, it's the stuff of science fiction. It is generally far less expensive to create new offensive weapons than it is to build defensive weapons against them. And it's unfortunate that we in this country have wasting $10 billion a year on a missile defense system that doesn't work. The idea of the deflector shields in Star Trek work by using gravity, but, you know, to bend space around a ship. But let's be clear here. The sun, which is a million times more massive than the Earth, only bends space by about 1/1000th of a degree. And so, yeah, you can bend space, but, you know, you're not going to build, in order to curve space around and cause objects to move away like that, you need energies far in excess of the mass of the sun. And I really think that science fiction fallacy that you can build impenetrable shields in generally is partly responsible for this unfortunate fact that we in this country have built have created a missile defense system that keeps failing, yet we keep spending money on it, and we're trying to export it to Europe now. I think in some sense, this is one of the bad examples of where the hope of a science fiction reality has caused some very poor political policies here on Earth.
Oh, that's a good point. Let's go to the phones now. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing great, sir. Go ahead.
George, I appreciate you taking my call. I did want to ask the gentleman a basic question.
Sure.
In talking and saying about the Big Bang theory, and also when he mentioned evolution, those two subjects he mentioned earlier on in the conversation, on at least 3 to 4 times, he went from saying, we know this happened, to mentioning the word theory. And yeah, obviously, he's a very intelligent man. He understands that words mean something. Theory means something. And it means it's a guess, it's an idea.
That's a very good point. I'm glad you raised it. Because you hit an important aspect of what I was really doing wrong. In science, theory means something very different than it does in popular parlance, and I should have been clear about that. In science, theory is as good as you can get. Newton's theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of general relativity. What that means is it's a scientific idea that has been tested over and over and over again and only agrees with the data, but it's every single prediction has then been validated by every experiment that has been performed. And we use that to describe the highest level of scientific understanding. So to call something a scientific theory is, in fact, about as good as you can get. I would actually go further. The theories are based on facts. Facts are things that we actually observe and measure. And in some sense, when one talks about evolution, really, one should say it's a theory of natural selection, but evolution itself is a fact. The discovery of the progression of fossils and diversity of life is just an experimental fact. But your point is well taken. I should have been clear that when I was talking theory, I meant theory in the scientific sense, namely something that has been validated by experiment and whose predictions, every one of which has thus far been in agreement with observation.
Okay, west of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hello there.
Hi, this is Carrie. I'm in Long Beach, California.
Hello, Carrie.
This kind of touches on what the last caller mentioned. I have a degree in anthropology, and I specialize in, as he stated, the theory of natural selection. But, you know, we were more inclined even to call it an elevated principle, evolutionary ideas. But there are some problems with evolution, I think, that don't get addressed enough. I think it's a beautiful idea and a beautiful theory, and I agree with you, Professor, that it's been manifestly proven again and again and again and again. But one of the biggest issues for me that always came up with evolution was the idea of speciation and the idea of individualization. And you're probably familiar with both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, with speciation, the idea that individuals within the species are representative of the species, but at the same time, as you know, each individual itself is made up of multiple organisms of whom they have their own genetic code. They have their own evolutionary path, even down to the cellular level with our own bodies. Mm-hmm. Our mitochondria are a distinct bacterial form with an entirely discrete genetic code that,
sure,
that's not dependent upon ours.
Yeah, no, that's true, and it's a fascinating aspect of evolution to try and understand how, well, in fact, as you probably know, that the current consensus, for example, as an example of how one can understand things, is that mitochondria probably, which are part of every cell in a human body, because they're the things that basically control and the oxygen in a cell, they probably, the conventional wisdom are, that they were probably separate microorganisms back in an early time, which in fact had a symbiotic relationship with cells and were adapted and incorporated into them. Because oxygen, it turns out, the early history of life on Earth was such that there was no oxygen on Earth. All the oxygen on Earth was created by life, which is really amazing. Oxygen is initially a poison. And in fact, one of the ways, for those interested in looking for extraterrestrial life, one of the ways we might be clear to if we looked at a planet to know that there was probably life on it would be to find oxygen in the atmosphere, because oxygen doesn't occur naturally in an atmosphere like the atmosphere of Earth. Life has to create it. But, I mean, your point is well taken. There remain many interesting puzzles in evolution, just as there remain interesting puzzles in gravity. But as I like to point out, there are many more papers in the scientific literature suggesting problems with gravity, with Newton's law of gravity, than there are problems with evolutionary biology. But we don't go around suggesting that we should stop teaching gravity in the public schools. And so, but your point is well taken. There are fascinating controversies at the edge of knowledge, and that is at the edge of knowledge, just not just in physics, but in biology. So while the basic foundation of evolutionary biology is sound, there are certain interesting questions which scientists want to try and understand, and that is having to do with speciation, etc. And so, but those are only possible to even ask because of the basic framework of evolutionary biology, which provides a framework for asking them.
Where do we stand as a nation with students graduating with degrees in physics compared to other countries? How strong
are we? Well, we have, as you know, there are problems. We have been falling behind in many ways in terms of science and engineering. I think in Japan, I think 60% of students graduate in science and engineering, and in China, something like 56%. In the United States, 32% of the students. And so it is true that we are having problems with getting good domestic students in science, and there are lots of reasons for it, I think, and it's complicated, and it goes to the level of teaching in primary school. But we really, in fact, that's part of the reason I try and spend so much time, in some sense, defending evolutionary teaching in schools, because we do such a bad job teaching science now, we can't afford to do a worse job, because if we want to be competitive in the 21st century in this country, in a technological world, we had better train a better prepared workforce than we're doing now. And the last thing we should be doing is further diluting our teaching of science.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up. Hello there.
Hello there, George. This is Harry calling out of Texas.
Sure.
I'd like to kind of expand on two comments that your guest made, one being no evidence of intelligent design, the other one being that if our everything we saw in space and the universe disappeared, it would have no impact. As far as intelligent design, I'm not going to deny that there's evidence of evolution, but the laws of physics to me, explain how intelligence, whatever you want to call it, God or whatever, how he makes the things happen that happen. And the reason I say that is physics doesn't change. As he stated, physics today will be the same laws a million years from now, which means to me that those were the laws from day one. Now, these laws of physics are what enable everything to exist the way it does, and for our life to exist, and for the planets to stay in alignment, and so on and so forth. So the statement that we have no evidence of intelligent design, to me, I compare that to the statement about gravity. We don't see gravity. We don't really understand what it is, but we know it exists. So we don't have to see it, and we don't have to understand it to acknowledge that it exists.
Well, let me jump in for a second.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, your point is well taken in the sense that some what you would call theists or deist scientists, in fact, Einstein in some sense was one of these, would say, look, the laws of nature to me are what I think of as God. That the laws of the fact that nature has these simple natural laws is remarkable, and I find that amazing. And for some scientists, that provides, you know, they would say, okay, something had to create those laws, and although other people would say, I don't think that's necessarily true, but some people would believe, okay, look, these laws themselves represent some kind of order in nature, and I understand that order to be divine. But that's accepted. That's fine. But what when we're talking about intelligence design, we're talking about saying, no, what people are arguing is that the laws of physics and chemistry and biology are not enough to produce the diversity of life on Earth, that you need specifically supernatural hand coming in and twisting things here and manipulating things there. And for that, there is no direct evidence. But the notion that indeed the nature is remarkable and governed by universal laws, and for some people, for them, that would suggest that that's divine. That I have nothing wrong with that idea. It doesn't particularly affect the way I do physics, whether you accept that or not. But I think, in that sense, there's nothing wrong with thinking that the laws of nature themselves are in some sense divine.
That's an understandable explanation of your viewpoint. The other statement you made was that everything we saw out in the universe, if it disappeared and was not there, would not impact the rest of the universe. And I'm an amateur astronomer, and everything, as far as I understand, relies on other things in the universe. Everything interacts with itself, the pull and the resistance. It's like a concert out there, a symphony. And if we were to disappear, I don't see how it could not impact.
Well, that's a really good question. And you're right, everything does impact on everything else. So law of the gravitational forces work across things. The point I was making, and this is really what's remarkable, is that the net gravity associated with everything we see is just 1% of the total gravitational force in the universe. And so when I say if you got rid of all the stars and galaxies, what we'd be doing is we'd be getting rid of 1% of the stuff in the universe. And the 99% of the universe would still be there. And so that's what I meant. I mean, it's like, it's true. It's absolutely true that if I remove a molehill from the Earth won't be the same. It'll be slightly different, but it won't be that different. And what is truly amazing, as we've discovered, is that we are the tip of a cosmic iceberg, that the stuff that we study with telescopes, the stars and galaxies, which are fascinating and beautiful, are themselves just the vast tip of a cosmic iceberg. And if you got rid of the tip, the iceberg would still be there. In fact, the iceberg analogy is a pretty good one. You know, if I got rid of the top part, the part of the iceberg that's floating above the water, well, the Titanic still would have gotten sunk.
So true. Who's developing technology to make the job of the physicist easier?
Physicists. I mean, the physics is a many-faceted discipline, and there are experimental physicists, and they're the ones who are developing at the earliest stages new technologies which engineers will later take over and produce new computers and other devices. And I think that's the other important thing for people to realize. Fundamental research is extremely important, even if it doesn't seem like it's going in a certain direction. If in the 1940s we'd asked scientists, if we'd said, you have to build a better computer, then we'd have computers now that have wheels and turns and knobs. But instead, that Bell Labs, they just let them go free, and what they invented was the transistor. And of course, it's changed our lives. It produced computers and everything we basically use to govern our lives now. Unfettered inquiry at a fundamental level is what is responsible for the health of our economy at the present time. And it may take 25 or 50 years for that to come to fruition. And so many people like me are worried when if the government doesn't support sort of basic research, because even if it doesn't seem like it has a useful application, down the road it will be responsible for the health of our economy in the rest of the century.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Happy Harvest Moon to both you gentlemen. How are
Thank you?
Thank
you, sir. Great.
Thank you. I'm fine.
Thank you. Okay, a quick statement and a quick question to the professor. Your analytical mind, and I'm just going to be honest with you, I think what you are trying to get across, your blunt honesty and what you feel, is very refreshing. And it's wonderful to hear. I absolutely have thoroughly enjoyed the program, and I learned a little bit.
Well, thank you.
I thought that was great.
Thank you.
And, of course, George, I want to tell you that I think that the most wonderful thing is your never-ending passion and spirit, and you give all of us hope. Every last one of us hope, and that's why I tune in every night to listen to you. Now,
thank you. Go ahead.
My question. Because of what you said, this goes back to the last caller, I think, a little bit, the tip of the iceberg, your knowledge are all of the knowledge of every physicist on this planet compared to the relative knowledge that we don't know that's out there. Wouldn't that not be kind of like the tip of the iceberg? And with that in mind, could there not be some form of intelligent life right here in our own solar system, and we may just not know it?
Well, that's the first part of your question. I'd say yes. I mean, I think what we understand is probably the tip of a cosmic iceberg, and in another century, we'll, I hope, if we continue to support research, which is not clear, but if we do, then we'll know an incredible amount more about the universe. And so yes, there's a great vast amount to be discovered. As far as intelligent life in our solar system, I think that's a much more unlikely. Well, I'd say it's virtually impossible. The reason being that we can detect, you know, with the Arecibo radio telescope on Puerto Rico, we could detect a light bulb, something with the strength of a 100-watt light bulb on Jupiter, okay? Our ability to detect signals in the solar system is remarkable, truly remarkable. And if anything was operating with any kind of intelligence, generating any kind of energy, I mean, intelligent things require energy. I mean, that's our big problem in the 20th and 21st century, is that to power our civilization requires energy. It would be virtually impossible to hide that in our solar system. It's just all too close, and we can study in incredible detail with not just with our telescopes, but with the satellites that we sent out throughout the solar system, the nature of the planets in our solar system, and we know that we can search for not only electromagnetic signals but generation of energy. There may be I would be very surprised if there weren't microbial life on other objects in our solar system, perhaps near the surface of Mars, perhaps in the oceans of Europa.
Well, with Mars, we'll find out soon enough. Stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with our special guest, Professor Lawrence Krauss. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're going to take final phone calls with our special guest, Professor Lawrence Krauss. Then next hour, it'll be Full Moon Open Lines. Anything goes on Coast to Coast AM. Professor, tractor beams, Star Trek, what do you think?
Well, they're neat. But again, the thing that's kind of funny about them is most often they violate a really basic law of physics, which is pretty simple, namely, Newton told us that if I pull you, you pull me. If you're holding a rope and I'm holding a rope and I'm pulling you, then you feel the rope pulling you, right? Okay?
That's right.
But
right.
Now, the funny thing about a tractor beam is, if I lassoed the moon with a rope and I pulled it really hard, what would happen is I ended up pulling myself towards the moon, not the moon towards me, right? Because I'm a lot lighter than the moon. And whether I use a rope or some fancy magnetic attraction or gravity, the Enterprise can't lasso a planet and pull it towards the Enterprise. Instead, the Enterprise will move towards the planet because, you know, when two things are pulling each other, the lighter thing moves towards the heavier thing, whether it's a rope or gravity or magnetism or any kind of force. So it's kind of one of the amusing bloopers in Star Trek is that they often lasso something that's much heavier than them and pull it into them, when in fact what would happen is they'd be pulling they pull towards the object. It happens actually on our space station when astronauts say are trying to tighten a screw on a space station. Okay, if they try and pull really hard on the wrench, what will happen is because they're lighter than the space station, they'll go around in a circle, but the space station won't. It's just the way it is.
Good point. To the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Mr. Krause.
Good morning.
George, we're presently passing through Jacksonville, Florida.
All right.
I have a question that I'd like to pose to your guest. I think he's got a well knowledge of science, and I appreciate that. And not to be hard to get along with, but I want to test it a little bit.
Okay.
My question is, sir, if I understood you correctly during the first hour, that you believe that we are a revolution designed instead of intelligent design, and if so, may I ask the following question to you, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Where did man evolve from as far as being a human being? Where did they evolve from? And I would like to not only just go back, but go back to where you really think the first human being may have evolved at. Like, was it possibly, and this is just what I've been told before, well, Roy, it was like maybe two cockroaches pulled DNA together, as we know it nowadays, in the water, and that's where man comes from. Well, where did those two cells come from? And I just don't believe I come from no rocks. But, hey, I'll take my answer off there because I'm driving a truck, and it'll be easier for me to copy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'll wait till you're off the air now. Okay.
There you go.
Well, you know, look, I understand your problem. And let me just say something very important. We do not know what the origin of the first life forms on Earth were. There are various plausible mechanisms by which self-replicating chemical organic compounds, initially inorganic compounds probably, could have been created. And there are lots of plausible scenarios. But we do not yet know what the origin of the beginning, the first forms of life on Earth are. However, and this is what's really important, evolution is not about the origin of life. It's about the origin of diversity. We do know that all life forms use exactly the same mechanism, DNA, to copy. We know they all use the same mechanism using something called ATP to store and generate energy. And we have incredible evidence of a lineage of an interconnectedness of life showing the evolution of new life forms and new species. So evolution is simply a mechanism describing once life existed, how it is possible for it to evolve, new species to create it, how it responds, how populations respond to be able to survive in different surroundings, and how different species will evolve in different surroundings to respond to those natural pressures. That's what natural selection is all about. And it's very simple, that in any population, you have a great deal of diversity, and those individuals in the population that are most capable of surviving in a given circumstance will be most likely to reproduce, and therefore those characteristics will persist. And so the bottom line is that your quandary is the same as the quandary of scientists. We are trying to understand the first life forms that existed on Earth. We don't yet know the answer, But just because we don't know that doesn't violate the fact that evolution, which is describing how the diversity of present life forms evolved over time, is a good explanation. Namely, it's the fact that we don't understand everything is not the same as saying we don't understand anything. We certainly do not understand the first life forms on Earth, just like we don't understand the first second of the Big Bang, but that doesn't mean we don't understand what happened afterwards. And what happened afterwards is described and explained by evolution. I hope that helps you a little bit. And the big question you might say, and maybe it makes you feel better, is that you might say, well, God was there at the beginning and created the first life forms, and from there evolution took over. And there's some people who feel that way, and that's fine. Right now, we don't know what the origin of life is on Earth.
100 physicists are in a room. Sounds like the beginning of a joke.
Yeah, it does.
What percent would you say believes in the Big Bang theory? Well, I use the word believe again.
Yeah, I mean, except that the Big Bang theory is a good explanation of everything we see.
Yeah.
100.
100%, really?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a good physicist, yeah.
What percent about the multiverse theory?
Oh, well, that's much more speculative. And I think there you'd say that probably those who study that would say, the majority, I would think, would now suggest that they would believe that our what we call our universe is not unique. And I happened to check that. I got an email from someone who said, universe means everything. How can it not be unique? And it's really a question of semantics. What I would say is what we see in all the galaxies and all the laws of physics and the universe that we see expanding may be just part of a larger structure, which may have other things. And I'd say the majority of physicists would now say that's probably likely.
And what percent would you say would not believe in intelligent design?
Intelligent design, as it's purveyed by those who are trying to interfere with the teaching of evolution in high schools, again, I'd say 0%. If you asked me, if some of them would say, is there purpose or design to the universe? Oh, then there'd be some fraction. Because everything we know about the universe doesn't violate the possibility that there was purpose or design at the beginning. But the claim that what we see can't arise by natural law the natural laws that we've discovered about the universe are not sufficient for explaining what we see in nature. Well, that's just not true. They are completely sufficient to explain everything we see. It doesn't mean that there's stuff we can't see, but they're firstly perfectly sufficient. So I think I'd have to say again, 0% of any, there's no, and in fact, in the scientific literature, there is no scientific literature on intelligent design. If you look at scientific journals, there's been nothing. It hasn't led to any new discoveries about anything. There's just no articles because evolution, which is understanding how populations evolve by natural selection and mutation and change in character, is of vital importance, as I say, in everything, including the development of new vaccines. And so, whereas intelligent design, which is this vague statement that life is designed, has not yet led to any discoveries about anything. It's just not in the literature.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. I'm sure Professor Krauss is familiar with entanglement and the spontaneous action at a distance, where, say, a particle here can affect what happens to a particle like a million light years away as long as they came about in the same event?
Well, as long as they came in, very important, not just as long as they were created in the same event, but as long as they haven't been disturbed by any other physical process in the intervening time. That's okay. Very important. I don't want to, maybe I'll let you finish your question before I explain entanglement, so maybe why don't you go on?
Okay, well, there's also the no signaling proposition that says you can't use this instantaneous action to send information.
Yes.
That we can't have faster than light communication. My question is merely, what if instead of just looking at one particle, you look at an ensemble, and so it kind of complicated for the rest of the callers, you could be able to somehow tell if, let's say, 1,000 photons only went down one path in the beam splitter, an interferometer, instead of both.
Well, okay, so let me just step back for the listeners who are experts. entanglement is a weird property of quantum mechanics, which says, in fact, that particles, if you prepare a state very carefully, say two particles, in a quantum state, and they evolve and they move throughout the universe, and they're now a million light years away, if I do an experiment on one, I make a measurement on one, it will instantaneously affect the state of the other. Now, that is absolutely true. As far as we can tell, the laws of physics tell us that. But it's very important that they haven't been disturbed by anything else. They've never interacted. They've never absorbed or received light, because that will destroy the entanglement. Now, what the listeners, what the gentleman is asking is, why can't we use that in any way to send signals? Even if you have many particles, if I make some measurement of many particles here and somewhere else, they affect the properties of those many other particles, won't I be sending a signal? And the answer is, unfortunately, no. Because it turns out, while I will make measurements on the particles here, they will affect the properties of particles somewhere else. Unless I make a telephone call or somehow let the experimenter know at the other end what I'm doing at this end, there's no way that he will see anything strange happening at that end. He'll just see, you know, if I measure the spin of a particle here to be up, he'll measure the spin down. If I measure it down here, he'll measure it to be up there. But there's nothing unusual about measuring the spin of a given particle to be down or up. And the only way he would know that his experiment is being affected is if I telephoned him or told him that I was about to make this measurement, but that telephone call happens at the speed of light. So there's no way, unfortunately, entanglement can be used to send signals faster than the speed of light.
Okay, thanks. A couple more calls will be done, at least for this hour. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is Tom in Woodland.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead, sir. Woodland, California.
Yeah, right. I have a question for the professor. You're talking about space travel and time and everything, and I just have it's probably a naive question, but there's the four dimensions. We got the three space and the one time, mm-hmm. But I'm questioning is time really a dimension, in that it's so radically different from the others.
Well, I mean, it's a dimension in the sense that Einstein first, actually it was Einstein's teacher, Minkowski, who first recognized this, but that one person's spatial interval can be another person's time interval. So that space and time can be exchanged for observers moving at different velocities. So if you're moving very fast with respect to me, things that I measure to happen at the same instant in time for me, therefore there's no time interval between them, but separated in space, will be for you, look like they have a time interval, but the space separation will be different. So space and time can be converted into one another a little for different observers, and therefore time acts in that sense like another dimension. However, you're right in the sense that time is very different, as far as we can see, than space, and one of the ways is that while I can do a loop in space, I can go into the next room and come back. So far as we know, you can't make a loop in time. And yeah, that's a big, interesting question, and we just don't know the answer.
I was thinking that time is more like a line where you have three states of movement to the right, left, and stop, but time is only one direction.
Well, that's right, perhaps, but we don't know. If time travel were possible, and we can't say it's impossible, then at least that aspect of time would seem to be more similar to space. But right, you're right that time certainly, there's no doubt. You ask any child if time and space seem the same, and the time will... So I'll say, no, the future is different than the past, whereas left isn't so different than right.
Right.
And, we just don't know whether that difference is just an illusion or not.
And I had one more question here about, if quantum computing says that you can have a particle in two spaces at two places at the same time, wouldn't that imply movement without time?
No, it really implies that what we mean, it just means that our classical picture of a particle, it's not moving between those two places. It's literally not in one place or the other. Our classical picture of a particle is not appropriate. The particle is, in some vague sense, spread out. Just like, a mountain isn't in the same. A mountain is distributed in space. It's a big thing. And it turns out even very small particles are in many places at the same time, although it turns out many generally microscopically separated. We can create things so that very carefully that property is preserved over macroscopic distances. It's very hard. But the bottom line is that it's just quantum mechanics is really strange, and all our classical notions of objects like baseballs and pool balls and pinballs and bumps don't work at that scale, and they're not appropriate. But it certainly doesn't imply movement without time. It may seem to, but that's just the classical. That's just because our classical minds can't really picture the mathematics.
Let's go east of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hello, Mr. Norrie, Professor Krauss. I was listening to your comment you made about the deflector shields,
uh-huh.
and that you don't believe that they're possible.
Well, I mean, they're impenetrable shields.
Well, impenetrable is one thing, but...
Well, of course shields are possible. The Romans had them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can make a shield. The question is, okay, I make a shield, but then I can always... It turns out I can always get around that by making a bullet, an armor-piercing bullet. And impenetrable shields generally are not only not possible, but cost a lot more than... If you're a nation trying to build a shield, it's a lot cheaper to build a bullet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, the thing is, with the deflector shields on Star Trek, as I understand them, would be a projection of what we now call magnetohydrodynamics.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, of course, you have to ask the writers, but if you look at what they say, they actually say they use bending gravity. But, you know, you could use magnetism, but magnetism isn't that... I mean, neither of them are particularly strong forces, and you need incredible magnetic fields to deflect things very, very. You can certainly do it. Magnetism allows you to deflect things, except things that aren't magnetic. But you need incredible power to do it, and it doesn't do it very efficiently.
Any secrets out there, Lawrence, that with a minute or so to go, that we need to know what's out there technologically? Anything?
Well, I like to say if I knew what the next big thing was, I'd be doing it right now.
Ah, I wish we could then. Flying car, you're going to buy one when they come out?
A flying car?
Uh-huh.
Oh, absolutely, when they come out, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know. I just wouldn't mind a car that gets better gas mileage.
Lawrence, thanks for being on the program. 2 years, way too long. Come back again, okay?
Okay, it was great, and thanks to your listeners as well.
And I shall be back in a moment with Full Moon Open Lines, so get ready to rumble here on Coast to Coast AM.